Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is now 1:05 p.m. It is Friday, March 31st, 2017. And before we begin, I want to thank, as always, Christy Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Tom Raymond from the Juno LIO, who's here to make sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. We have present today Representative Eastman, Representative Kopp, Representative Reinbold, Representative Ledoux, and myself, Representative Clayman. Our Vice Chair, Representative Fanzler, is excused, and we do have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is a confirmation hearing for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. Two additional appointments have been referred to the House Judiciary Committee, and members have received their resumes at their offices for both appointees, and I believe both Ms. Fancher and Mr. Holmes are online, so we will now open for invited testimony. Ms. Fancher, are you online? Can you hear us, Ms. Fanchler?
I'm here.
Okay. And I probably mispronounced your name, Ms. Fancher. If you could go ahead, state your name for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Deborah Fancher, and I am honored to be considered for the position. What are you looking for?
Well, if you just want to tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about why you would like to serve on the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics, it doesn't have to be very long.
Okay, that's always scary when you ask a teacher not to be very long. My name is Deborah Fancher. I have been a lifelong Alaskan. My parents came here when I was three, moved to Bush, Alaska, grew up in Gakona, which for those of you that don't know where that is, it's about 30 miles from Glen Allen. Have been in Alaska ever since the time I was three, which was, my folks were here about 1967, so that means I've been here 50 years, except for a stint at college. I got a degree in chemistry from the University of Washington, came back to Alaska to have my student loan, part of my student loan, forgiven, because at the time there was an amazing program in place to get students to come back, and so I was one of those that came back. When I got back to Alaska, I worked for the health department in Anchorage for 3 years, and then I was called to be called to interview for a teaching position. Didn't really plan on taking it, but summers off seemed incredibly appealing at the time. I spent 3 years teaching at Service High School, then another 10 years teaching at East High School. I was going to be teaching at South when South opened, and another position presented itself at Grace. I spent 10 years teaching at Grace, so I retired 2 years ago after 23 years, and I am married. I have two grown sons. And why I am interested in serving, I think that it's interesting because I met with Jerry Anderson, who is in charge, kind of oversees the committee, and he said that he knew that would be one of the questions when I was asking him earlier in the week about the expectations, and so Jerry graciously gave me about 2 hours of his time, and I wanted to come up with something clever, and, you know, the reality is I'm just in a season in life where I think learning it's gotten to be really fun. I have time to do this, and I was trying to come up with an analogy, and the best analogy I could come up with is we've all probably been at an event and a party, and at the end of the event of the party, there's always things that need to be taken care of. Chairs need to be put away, dishes need to be washed, the garbage needs to be taken out, and when you're in the thick of working and parenting and doing all those things, you don't necessarily have that time. Well, I'm at a season in my life where I can put up the chairs and I can take out the garbage, and in the meantime, I can learn a whole bunch. So anything else I can answer?
Thank you very much. I'm looking to see if anyone on the committee has questions for Ms. Fancher. And I see no questions. So thank you very much. The next person that we have is Mr. Lee Holmes. Mr. Holmes, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
And if you would go ahead, state your name for the record, and you can proceed with your testimony about your interest in serving on the, or your background and your interest in serving on the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics.
Okay. Name is Lee Holmes, and by profession, I'm a mechanical engineer with Sports Services of Alaska. Right now, I mostly do commissioning work, which is starting up buildings and going in and making them work right. I've been in Alaska since 1983. I have three sons, one of which is still in Alaska, two are outside. And I've been on a lot of social and arts-related committees throughout Anchorage and a few of the statewide committees for math counts and helping the fire marshal with code language and such. And I'm a firm believer that Alaska has given me the opportunity to succeed the way I have, has given me the opportunity to create a life for myself and my family. And I believe it's important for the individuals to give back to the community that allowed them to have that success. And on a state level, I just thought it would be a good position to be able to help the state and everybody in the state by volunteering to be on the committee. And that's kind of it.
Thank you very much. I first want to recognize that Representative Christ Tompkins has joined us, and I believe Representative Eastman has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, I noticed you are a member of the NFPA. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
The National Fire Protection Association is a it's a national organization that was originally created by fire chiefs and fire marshals around the country. And it's evolved over the years as the de facto codes that you use for all of your fire protection in the state. So a fire sprinkler system would be installed and designed NFPA standards. NFPA also has a model building code that the state uses the international building codes instead of the NFPA building codes. But probably the most familiar NFPA code is they are the authors of the National Electric Code, which is pretty much uniform throughout the United States and North America. And so being a member of that just gives me access to all of the documentation so that I can readily know whether or not something's going incorrectly.
Representative Eastman, follow up. Mr. Holmes, if you want to back up just a little bit from your phone because we're getting a little feedback. That may be on our end. I'm not quite sure. I think Representative Eastman has a follow-up. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so to follow up, curious whether or not you specifically chose the Ethics Committee or was that something that was suggested to you? And do you know very many members of the legislature?
Actually, it was pointed out to me that there was going to be an opening, and I went in and I looked at it, and then through Gary Anderson, found out what the process was to submit for that position. And as far as members of the legislature that I know or have dealt with in the past, Representative Clayman, when he was mayor of Anchorage, confirmed me for back on to the Municipal Arts Advisory Commission for the Municipality of Anchorage. So I'm not sure if you remember that momentous occasion. I do know a few legislators through different aspects of friendship and working with them. Chris Birch, I've known as an engineer. We both worked together back in the 80s for the Alaska Professional Design committee back then, and then let's see, there's Shrews Mills, who is a friend through PJ at Little Italy. Then Berta Gardner, I bought her old house, 17 years ago. And trying to think who else I know personally. I've met with my representative, which is Andy Josephson, and I've kind of worked with Les Guerra on some stuff for Anchorage One a few years back, and then just some of the different people that I've met off and on, but I think those are the ones that would probably be able to name me by name.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions from members of the committee. I would just note that I do recall when you were when I appointed you to the post with the city, and I'm glad to see that your service was so well liked that others after me continued that service. And glad you have been contributing to the community in a lot more ways than that. And I don't see any other questions from the committee. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Judiciary Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the Chief Justice's appointees and recommends that the following names be forwarded to the House ratification, or I would so move.
And it's not a motion.
Oh, excuse me. And so Deborah Fancher and Lee Holmes are the two that the Chief Justice has appointed, and note that this does not reflect the intent of any members to vote for or against these individuals during further sessions for the purposes of ratification.
Thank you. After we adjourn or else during the course of the proceedings, please be sure to sign the confirmation committee reports as to both of these individuals. Our only other order of business today is House Bill 79, Omnibus Workers' Compensation, sponsored by the House Rules Committee upon request of the governor. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee, and here to present the bill is, looks like, Commissioner Dragas and Marie Marks, Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. Would you both please come forward, identify yourself for the record? And also, of course, as you know, as a matter of protocol, when you're answering questions, be sure to identify yourself so our recording secretary can attribute the answer correctly. And I know we have there's a PowerPoint on the screen, but we also have printouts of the PowerPoint. Does the committee want to dim the lights to watch the PowerPoint or just work off your paper version? Any preferences? I see no one wanting to dim the lights, so we'll...
Oh, yeah.
We will stay with the paper version. Can the people in the audience see okay? Would you prefer that we have... That's what? Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing HB 79 today. For the record, my name is Heidi Dragas. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. This bill before you will speed up resolution of disputes, improve the delivery of benefits to injured workers, deter workers' compensation fraud, reduce administrative costs, and provide adequate funding for the administration of the workers' compensation system. The legislature has consistently endeavored to create a workers' compensation system that delivers benefits quickly, efficiently, fairly, and predictably to injured workers at a reasonable cost to employers as mandated by statute. The system has not been significantly reformed in more than 10 years. The improvements in this bill address rising costs, recent legal developments, and new approaches to improve the system's efficiency and fairness. This bill focuses mainly on efficiencies and modernization of the current system. The department recognizes that benefit issues such as reemployment benefits and medical costs need attention. Thanks. The department is committed to addressing those issues in another legislative session. This bill has also undergone improvements since its introduction after working with many stakeholders to clarify the definition of independent contractor. This is a critical piece of this legislation, which aims to provide a level playing field for employers to operate and provide fairness to workers. Here to take the committee through the bill is Marie Marks, who is the Division Director for the Workers' Compensation Division.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Again, for the record, my name is Marie Marks, and I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. I wanted to start. Do you want to drive for me?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I'll drive.
I want to start with the intent of the act set out in statute to highlight the pillars of the workers' compensation system. As the commissioner stated, it's to ensure the quick, efficient, fair, and predictable delivery of benefits to injured workers at a reasonable cost to employers. Balancing of these pillars guides the division's administration of the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act. And just to touch on what the Workers' Compensation Division does, it ensures compliance with the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act. It conducts workers' compensation hearings. It operates an appeals program. It processes fishermen's funds claims, and it administers a vocational rehabilitation benefits and training program for injured workers. The governor's bill addresses all of the statutory pillars, but especially focuses on fairness, quickness, and efficiency in the workers' compensation process. Because HB 79 is an efficiencies bill, it's a large one with changes to topics made throughout the bill. I thought it would be more helpful to the committee members if instead I conducted the sectional analysis by topic instead of numerical order. So to start, sections 8 through 10, 16 through 18, and 36 speed up dispute resolution in various ways. HB 79 simplifies and quickens the hearing process by letting the board schedule a hearing shortly after a claim is filed instead of waiting for an employee to request a hearing. It also ends the practice of permitting non-attorneys who are not bound by rules of ethical and professional conduct like attorneys are from representing parties before the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board. I just want to clarify that a parent of a minor, guardian, or other court-appointed representative may still represent a party in board proceedings. Additionally, the board will continue, as it always has done, to consider a company, employer, or medical provider to be self-represented when acting through an authorized employee, member, or partner, or a corporate executive officer. And this change does not affect a party's ability to be represented by an attorney, including an attorney's ability to employ the services of paralegals and delegating functions to them, because that's governed by the Alaska Rules of Professional Conduct. There is no change to the board practice of allowing that, and we will continue to allow that. However, other non-attorneys may not represent a party in matters before the board.
We'll see how we go with taking questions as they go. Go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to do it now or later, but I just if you could just one more time clarify, because it says non-attorneys may not represent parties in House Bill 79, but it sounded like you made some exceptions there, so it was ambiguous.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, yes, I just would like to clarify, and the PowerPoint, I try to not do as much detail as more of a guide for my presentation, and that's why I'll probably clarify things in the presentation. But you are correct that right now non-attorneys can represent parties before the board, and you're right. The change is that except for parents of a minor, guardians, court conservators, that type of thing, non-attorneys may not.
Hmm. Representative Ledoux.
Yeah, just a couple of questions right now. So as the law currently stands, is there a prohibition on non-attorneys being paid for their services?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the Alaska Attorney Rules Professional Conduct guide what is unauthorized practice of law. And that really is a matter for the Bar Association, whether a non-attorney who may be representing parties is practicing law and receiving fees for that. Under our statutes, only attorneys can get attorney's fees. Only attorneys can be paid for representing claimants before the board. And the board has to approve those attorney's fees that are paid. If a non-attorney is representing a claimant, there is nothing that is submitted to the board because they're not an attorney and thus no attorney fee to approve. So we don't know whether they are receiving fees. They could be, they could not be, but that would really be an authorized practice of a law issue, I believe, not one for the board.
Follow-up, Representative Ledoux.
So what kind of concerns me about this, and maybe you can tell me whether there have been, whether there's a problem here, is there are really so few attorneys in this state who practice workers' compensation law. And I know, for example, when I used to live in Kodiak, there simply was nobody there that did it. I think there are basically a couple of law firms, just a couple, that do workers' comp law. And the fee schedule in workers' comp cases, at least it's my understanding, is not lucrative enough that there are very many attorneys who are interested in practicing in the field, for at least for the claimants. So it sort of concerns me that we may be lessening the number of options for people who have a claim.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I guess what I would say is I think we are improving the number of good options. And anecdotally, when I served as an administrative judge, a workers' compensation hearing officer, anecdotally, my experience was those claimants who were represented by non-attorneys who are not bound by ethical rules or professional rules of conduct did not make their case proceed more efficiently or have better outcomes. And we have staff specifically there to help unrepresented claimants and employers, unrepresented employers. Workers' compensation technicians provide information about the Workers' Compensation Act and rights and duties of all parties. And workers' compensation officers will actually sit down and provide information to parties about how to pursue their right to compensation. So we provide that assistance. And attorneys, when they represent a claimant or uninsured employer, they can provide that assistance as well. But most parties before the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board are unrepresented. It is meant to be an informal process, and that is why we provide so much assistance to unrepresented parties before the board. And so in some, I don't think it makes a better option, and I don't think it is better in the best interest of claimants or employers.
Thank you.
Representative Reinbold.
Well, thank you. But with your opening statements, I'm going back to my original, the non-attorneys may not represent parties. You say that it's going to be cheaper, et cetera, you know, bring down costs. Well, my opinion is attorneys almost always end up adding a lot more money to the process. And I know this might be interpreted as a snarky comment. Maybe it is, maybe it's not. But the bottom line is the doctors.
Representative Reinbold, if you want to describe it as a snarky comment. Sure. We want to argue with you.
Well, it's and that's why I said you guys can interpret it however you wish. I'll give you the liberty to do that. But I know the doctors have been complaining about House Bill 123 that we just heard, and they keep encouraging me to ask all the lawyers to post their fees as you walk in the door, and on the state should collect all their fees and post them as well. And I think this is a good example. If they're going to be forced to have an attorney, I think it's only fair that they post, you know, their fees on the door and the state collect those fees and post them so people can shop, you know, for their attorney as well, so we can bring costs, because litigation is one of the biggest problems we have in this state.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, attorney's fees and the high cost of attorney's fees is absolutely an issue that we are addressing in this bill. And we agree, it is an issue. And that is why, for example, instead of letting the parties dictate when they go to hearing, when they're ready for a hearing after 2 or 3 years of litigation, the board, when they come in, will set a hearing scheduling order, just like trial courts do, just like other administrative agencies do. Everyone will know when the hearing is, whether it's a year down the road or so forth, and set a discovery schedule to rein in, I think, some of the high costs associated with these cases.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A moment ago, I heard you say improving options for claimants. I don't see any new options here. Did you rather mean you are decreasing bad options the state has decided are not good?
through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think that probably would have been a better way to say it.
Representative Ledoux.
So I thought attorney's fees in workers' compensation cases were like set by statute, and that maybe when a case was, it's been so long since I've dealt with any workers' compensation stuff. How does it work? How does the fee schedule work with workers' comp?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, there is no fee schedule. It is, in most cases, it's full, actual, reasonable attorney's fees related to the issues upon which they prevail. And so there is another provision that says it's 10% of the 10% off the top of my head, I think that's the number, of the benefits you receive. But the other option, there's two options, and the second option that almost all attorneys tend to fall into is full reasonable attorney's fees upon on the issues upon which you prevail. And so it's there's not a cap set under the statute. And some states have looked at capping that, and I think some states have done so. And I looked into this issue, and it's my understanding at least one court, I think, found that those types of caps are unconstitutional because I think the Supreme Court has that jurisdiction to regulate caps on attorney's fees and so forth.
Commissioner Dreyfus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing I would also like to message is that, just as Marie said, we are addressing rising litigation costs, and a lot of those costs are driven up by delays. And so this bill addresses the problem of delays in the work comp system. That is something that we're very aware of, and we'd like to create some cost containment on that. In very smart, efficient ways.
I think you can continue. I think you've answered. So,
sure. HB 79, it streamlines settlement agreements as part of speeding up dispute resolution. It streamlines settlement agreements by eliminating a requirement that the board approve attorney's fees as part of a settlement agreement when attorney's fees are the only issue in the settlement that requires board approval. It also streamlines the process of opposing civil penalties against uninsured employers by allowing the Division of Workers' Compensation to assess the civil penalty directly rather than petitioning the board to set the penalty. And then an employer who disputes the assessed penalty may challenge the assessment before the board. Sections 14, 20, and 22 to 23 improve the delivery of medical care by requiring employers to pre-authorize or deny medical treatment upon a medical provider's written request and providing a reasonable time frame, 60 days, for an employer to respond, either accepting it or denying the pre-authorization request without incurring a penalty. Currently, there is no language in the Act specifically addressing a request for pre-authorization of medical treatment. This has led to litigation and delayed delivery of medical care to injured workers. The last bullet point, stating no change, it's just to clarify that medical bills still must be paid within 30 days, just because the division had received some questions on that. Misclassification. Misclassification is a topic the division is committed to addressing on behalf of both workers and law-abiding businesses. We are doing a great disservice to both when we do not tackle misclassification head on. When workers are fraudulently misclassified, workers die or severely injured, and uninsured losses, huge uninsured losses, can put an employer out of business. HB 79 does not prevent true independent contractors from existing and flourishing. Instead, it clarifies the definition of independent contractor. Having a clearer definition will help businesses be successful and in compliance from the very beginning, and it will help workers clearly understand what it means to be an independent contractor. It does not change, I just want to note, it's a narrow application. It does not change the definition of independent contractor for other purposes, such as IRS status and other non-workers' compensation laws. We must keep workers safe, and law-abiding employers should not have to pay the price for misclassification and should be able to operate on a level playing field with other businesses.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you. And
I'm still stuck on slide number 5, if you could go back there. You jumped this pretty quickly, and this is kind of a big deal. Knowing healthcare is something I've been involved with for so many years, it's just hard for me to overlook this. So if you could please describe on line 2, it says there's going to be a penalty for untimely preauthorization or denial. Who is that penalty being given to? And if you can describe, that whole process, because preauthorization is a nightmare, often for medical offices and also for the patients. So this is kind of a big deal.
Representative Randall, just you're saying preauthorization is a nightmare for the medical providers because they keep waiting to hear from the insurance companies?
Oftentimes, yes. Okay. Like a Blue Cross Premier, oftentimes they're on hold forever. I mean, it's just like they have a tremendous amount. I did workers' comp for 2 years, and it's a very, very challenging field, I can tell you that much. But anyway, if you could address that would be
sure.
Great.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, currently what the statute states is that upon being presented with a medical bill, that an employer or insurer has 30 days to either pay that bill or deny it, controvert it. And if they don't do one of those two things within that 30-day period, they owe a 25% penalty of the amount of what they should have paid. That's currently in statute. What this bill does is says, similarly, if they do not pre-authorize or deny within 60 days, giving them a little more time, because a medical bill, by the time that you get the medical bill, the treatment has already been provided. But as you noted, pre-authorization can be just a phone call. So there's a little more time needed to review records. If they don't either pre-authorize or deny that within 60 days, 25% penalty is due on the amount estimated in the bill, subject, of course, to the Alaska medical fee schedule.
Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up, Representative Ryan.
Just a point of clarification, please. Who is the penalty being assessed to? That's where I'm trying to go.
Through the
with
chair,
this.
Representative Reinbold, the entity that should have paid or authorized, and so it's either the employer or the self-insured employer, the uninsured employer, or the insurance company.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, now I know from personal experience and testimony that we have limited health insurance options here in Alaska. I can see two concerns here for increasing the risk of penalty to an insurer. One might simply be that those who are looking at providing coverage in Alaska decide not to, which might not be a good thing. But the other, maybe more tangible, is if I can avoid the penalty simply by denying coverage, doesn't that give an incentive to deny coverage? Have we looked at the implications, consequences of what might happen?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, what happens currently now I don't think is better. And what happens now is a treating physician is reluctant to go forward with, for example, let's say a knee surgery, unless they know that it's going to be authorized and paid for. The injured worker does not necessarily want to go forward with that cost if they think that they're going to be left having to pay that if it's found later not to be work-related. And the insurance company or the self-insured employer says, my only duty under statute is to pay a bill, so you go get the care, and we'll tell you after you get it and incur the fees whether we'll pay for it or not. And so what ends up happening right now is an injured worker has to go to a hearing before the board, which can take much longer than 60 days, to get an answer on whether or not that bill should be paid or not. And so I think that this system, this proposed change, which is the result of litigation, there was a recent Supreme Court case that kind of highlighted this issue, which is why we're addressing it here. It has led to litigation because it's just ambiguous. So the goal is to provide clarity to parties on this issue.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, just to clarify, too, if an employer...
You could identify yourself again.
I apologize. This is Commissioner Heidi Dragas. If an employer or an insurer, self-insured employer, denies coverage, at least then the worker has an answer and can appeal that decision to the board or live with the decision, but the process can continue a little bit more efficiently. But this is a key provision of the bill.
Follow-up, Representative Eastman.
Yes. appreciate that, and I do think this is a key provision of the bill. I'll just say I'm slightly skeptical only because having been a state employee recently and looking at some of these issues being unresolved more than a year after I left state employment, 30 days might be premature. I don't know that, that implementing that penalty is necessarily going to solve the problem, but we can talk about that. Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
So on pre-authorization, it seems like 60 days is an awful long time to either approve or deny it. If the employer is not controverting that the injury happened at work, so if that's a given, why would the insurance company need 60 days? I mean, when, as a state employee, and I have state insurance, and if I were going to need a knee operation, I mean, I assume that the doctor would just get pre-authorization, and it would just be a telephone call. So why would anybody need 60 days for it?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think the difference between paying a bill, reviewing a bill, and deciding whether somebody should seek treatment for something is a little more, it's a little more intensive as far as fact-finding. You have to go through the medical records to determine sort of what has been the treatment thus far, what has worked, what hasn't, is it work-related. It's a little bit more intensive than simply paying a bill, and that's why we decided that 60 days would be a more appropriate time frame for that to take place.
And then just follow up.
Representative Ledoux.
So if they don't do it within 60 days, there's a penalty. So who does the penalty go to? Does that go to the claimant or the physician?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the penalty is paid to... Oh. For the record, my name is Marie Marks, Director of Workers' Compensation.
You all are just going back and forth, so it helps if you remember to say who's speaking.
The penalty is due is to whoever is owed the money. So if the self-insured employer, insurance company, or uninsured employer should have paid that bill, or then they must pay the penalty to the provider, if the provider is the one who has had an unpaid bill. If the claimant... paid it out of pocket and is submitting a claim for reimbursement, then that is not paid on time, then the penalty would be due to the claimant. So it's whoever is should have been paid and wasn't paid on time.
Thank you.
All right, I have no one in the queue right now. Go ahead.
Sure, and I did want to go back just quickly to slide 5 and this point that benefits except medical currently are paid every 14 days with a 7-day grace period. We're just calling a spade, and we're saying benefits except medical are paid every 21 days.
Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Ledoux. Sorry, I'm busy.
So benefits are, for example, the payment that you're supposed to live on, right?
The chair, Representative Ledoux, correct. It's what we call indemnity, which is the lost wages.
Okay, so...
And for the record, Marie Marks, Workers' Compensation Director.
So, I guess I've got a problem with 21 days or even 14 days with a 7-day grace period. I mean, most people are used to jobs that pay every 2 weeks or bi-monthly. So I guess I don't understand why, if you're injured and you're supposed to be getting indemnity, why it should be any more than 14 days, period, with no grace period and with a penalty if it's not paid within 14 days.
Commissioner Dragas.
The chair, Representative Ledoux, this is Commissioner Heidi Dragas. I mean, I think that's a good point to be made. What we were frustrated by is that we had a statute that said medical payments are paid every 14 days, but you get a 7-day grace period, and everybody knew that was 21 days. So we just decided to make it let's make it abundantly clear, it just means 21 days. I mean, I think as far as changing that time period, it is not something that we propose in the bill. It's really, I guess, a policy decision for the legislature. We just wanted to clarify that we wanted to call it for what it was, exactly, basically.
Would you
follow up, Representative Ledoux?
And if somebody wanted to make that policy change, would you oppose it or would you concur with it?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, again, this is Commissioner Dragas. I don't see a problem with that. I believe that's a question for stakeholders involved that are in the business of paying indemnity benefits. And that is why the statute said what it said, is that it was a 14-day period, but we'll give you a seven-day bumper period.
But employers, just through the chair, employers, when they are paying people salaries, they don't get a grace period. They need to pay on time or they fall afoul of both federal and state statutes.
Through the chair, that's correct. And I should say, some employers pay individuals differently. I don't think every single employer has to pay people biweekly. I think some employers pay at the end of the week. Some employers pay at the end of the month. I think it varies as long as there's a regular pay period.
Follow-up, Representative Ledoux.
Through the chair. I mean, yeah, you're right. It's different. But of all the employers that I've ever had in my life, it's always been either a weekly, bi-weekly, or a semi-monthly. I mean, a monthly pay period might be something that one does when one is, for example, an independent contractor and is doing a consulting contract. But, I mean, I think it's very uncommon for an actual employee to be paid monthly.
And through the chair, Representative Ledoux, for the record, Marie Marks, Director of Workers' Compensation. Because there's no grace period, it would seem to be in the best interest of those making those payments that they would go out every 14 days to ensure that they are on time, since there is no grace period. So it would seem to be in their best interest that they would continue the practice of what they were doing. We're just for calling it what it is. It's really 21 days.
Representative Lou,
and I understand that. My suggestion is that it should be 14 days with a penalty if it's not paid within 14 days.
And that sounds like that might also be a subject of an amendment before we move the bill, because she certainly has the opportunity to make those changes. And then next, Representative Reinbold.
Thank you. And I hope the representative from Muldoon doesn't mind me disclosing a common phrase between us. But it's Friday, so why not? But we always say around these hallways for the past 5 years, if we agree on something, it's like monkeys making Mozart or monkeys writing Shakespeare. Because we don't agree that often. And this is a typical where I am going to disagree with her. So I absolutely, I used to run a business office in a hospital, and I think this is beyond reasonable. I absolutely think that grace period is absolutely necessary, and I think that these are reasonable. So with that, she knows where I stand, because I can tell you that we had workers' comp claims that would go on, it seems like, for eternity. I mean, I couldn't close out the books. I couldn't. Our accounts receivable was always those workers' comp or those auto claims that we just couldn't get settlements on. And I actually think this is beyond reasonable. And it appears on first blush, I need to have the experts weigh in, but at first blush, it looks to be reasonable to me. Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My impression, just having heard the conversation at this point, is that this change is probably not a step forward. I understand the argument that it's not actually going to change anything tangibly, and that may be the case, but I don't think we should be encouraging benefits not to be paid until 21 days. It would seem to me that's on the long side. If anything, I'd like to encourage them to be paid sooner, and this seems to be encouraging the opposite.
I'm not sure. I think that's, I'm going to view that more as a comment than a question. And if you would, can then proceed with your presentation. I would note that these are very interesting policy discussions, and we may do a better job of discussing those policy considerations at the conclusion of the presentation. Hopefully we'll get through that today.
Okay. Moving on to the strengthening fraud provisions, and the reason I started with misclassification overview is because Section 7, 9, 11, and 12, 25 to 26, and again, for the record, Marie Marks, Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation, Section 7, 9, 11 to 12, 25 to 26, 28, 31 to 35, and 37 strengthen provisions to prevent workers' compensation fraud by employers and employees. It defines when an employer's misclassification of employees amounts to fraud under the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act. It opposes an affirmative duty on employees receiving workers' compensation benefits to report work and receipt of other types of wage replacement benefits. It defines independent contractor instead of relying on a convoluted multi-factor test of employee status. It grants the division the ability to claim a lien on behalf of the Benefits Guarantee Fund, which is the injured worker fund, for compensation paid and for an assessed civil penalty. HB 69, I'm gonna switch sides for me. Expands the division's ability to assess a civil penalty to include employers who are underinsured because they have misclassified workers in a variety of ways that results in artificially low workers' compensation premiums, misrepresented the nature of their business, or engaged in deceptive leasing practices. It also changes the calculation and maximum civil penalty for a failure to insure for workers' compensation liability. Currently, the maximum is $1,000 for each uninsured employee workday, and this has led to two unintended consequences. The first is that the calculation has resulted in astronomically high penalties that do not withstand review on appeal and increase litigation costs and employer defaults. Second, uninsured employers that have not maintained required records are frequently penalized less severely than similar employers that have kept records as required by law because of the difficulty of establishing the number of uninsured employee workdays without records. The bill corrects these issues by setting a maximum penalty of three times the workers' compensation insurance premium that the employer would have paid had that employer properly insured its employees. This calculation is simpler because it requires only the employer's payroll data, calculated as if it had properly classified its employees, and the division of insurance's assigned risk rates for the nature of employer's business. The new penalty will result in a reasonable deterrent that takes into account the employer's size, the nature of the employer's business, and the financial gain that the employer realized by operating without paying in full or in part for workers' compensation insurance. HB 79 also clarifies that civil penalties may not be suspended. The Alaska Workers' Compensation Board often suspends penalties in full or in part to address an employer's ability to pay the astronomically high penalties resulting from the current statutory calculation. However, the penalty suspensions are really without sideboards. So the new calculation addresses this by really putting sideboards on the assessment and ties that calculation to the employer's size, type of business, and financial gain. The bill will allow an employer to enter into a payment plan to pay the civil penalty in installments. This ensures that an employer is not put out of business by a civil penalty assessment. And finally, it requires interest to be paid on these plans at the state rate for judgments, which currently is 4.25% for 2017. Sections 2 through 6, 13, 15, 19, 21, 24, 27, 29 to 30, 38, and 40 reduce administrative costs. Currently, there's a provision that says an employer must pay by check or incur a penalty. This is quite an old provision. Since then, payments now are made by direct deposit, electronic funds transfer, and so the bill just repeals that provision and allows employers to pay benefits by modern means. It allows the Division of Workers' Compensation to prescribe the filing format for reports of injury and compensation payments. I think right now our statute says that reports of injury have to be by stamped mailed envelope. And so this will allow the division to keep up with the times and for example, mandate electronic filing. HB 79 eliminates a requirement that corporate executive officers seek the division's approval before opting out of workers' compensation coverage for themselves. Corporate executive officers and members who have at least a 10% ownership interest are not considered under this bill employees of the business, so they do not need workers' compensation coverage. Of course, they can always opt in to coverage. Insurers can just look at the corporation's database for corporate or LLC documents to verify that. Next slide. HB 79 further reduces administrative costs by adding medical publications to a list that the Department of Labor and Workforce Development may incorporate, does not have to. It just allows the Medical Services Review Committee or the board to incorporate future amended versions of material being used as they are updated each year. It provides a penalty for insurers and employers that fail to timely submit proof of coverage in order to reduce the division's wasted efforts investigating insured employers that there was just a neglect to report insurance coverage. HB 79 also phases out the second injury fund, saving administrative costs for the department and reducing costs for employers, which are required to contribute to the fund. The second...
Mr. Chair. Representative Reinbold. Can and I apologize if sometimes in the dark I don't...
No problem. Well, you're carefully listening, which is great. Could you just... briefly describe the second injury fund to me, please, or us. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, Marie Marks, Director of Workers' Compensation. The fund's purpose is to encourage employers to hire or retain disabled individuals, but the fund is no longer necessary with the passage of the Americans with Disability Act and other laws that bar employment discrimination. Currently, you can't ask someone before you offer them a job whether they have a pre-existing disability. And so the purpose of the fund is being served by the American with Disabilities Act, and 19 states so far have phased out these funds. And so this is, it's administering a fund that I think no longer serves that its purpose.
Mr. Chairman, can I go?
Follow up, Representative Reinbold.
Thank you. Can you tell me how much is in that fund and where would it be going?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I do have the fund balance. For the fiscal year 2016, the second injury fund balance was $3,792,900. And the fund revenue comes in through an assessment against employers, self-insured employers, and insurance companies. Currently, it's 6% of non-medical benefits. They pay into this fund. And then qualifying insurers or self-insured employers or insurance companies can get reimbursed from that fund if they have hire someone with a pre-existing disability that has a subsequent injury. It has to be qualifying, and they may get reimbursed from that fund. So in all insurance companies and self-insured employers are paying into it, regardless of whether they're ever going to get reimbursed, but they're paying into it 6% of non-medical benefits, and other insurance companies and self-insured employers may get reimbursement from the fund. And so, and through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I don't know, do you want me to explain kind of the phase-out process? I know that's a question we had got.
Through the chair.
Do you want her to explain the phase-out process, or do you have a different question?
Yes, I would, and I would just like to, at the same time, if you don't mind, it seems like employers would love this. And I would also like to know where the money is going to be going. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll let her answer the phase-out process, which may describe where the money, what happens to the remaining money.
Yes.
If they don't have to pay it anymore, that probably is a non-issue, but go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the phase-out would include having a finite date, which no more claims for reimbursement will be accepted. And then we will then, at that point in time, know what the existing liability is. And most second entry fund claims are for permanent and total disability. So it's for the life of the claimant, which may be a little difficult to estimate. But we will have a certain number of claimants. And then as those claims are paid off over time, and I think we've estimated in the fiscal note an average age of 80 years old for each claim to be phased out, less money would need to be collected. And so the phase-out would not finish, be completed until generations. It could be decades, which is why we want to start now, decades from now. If we do it correctly, the amount of money taken in will slowly decrease over time as the liability shrinks. And if we work it out just right, decades from now, we can even maybe get an actuary to estimate it. Hopefully we'll have almost perfectly match the amount of money being taken in and given out. If there is some that is remaining, a small amount remaining from that, the bill, and I want to make sure I get this right, states that it will go to, and this is Section 40, that subject to appropriation, the balance of the second injury fund lapses into the general fund when all liability for accepted claims has been paid.
Representative Reinbold, follow up.
Nope, I'm good. I just wanted to say thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So I take it, just to make sure I'm following that answer, that it'll take years before the second injury fund, before the draws on the second injury fund go away, but the idea would be to adjust how much was collected based on the estimate of how much was needed.
Chair Klayman, that is correct.
Okay. All right, I don't see any other questions. You can proceed.
Okay, and the last section is Section 1, and that ensures adequate funding for the administration of the Workers' Safety and Compensation Administrative Account. It's a mouthful, so I'll refer it to WISCA. I try to avoid acronyms, but it's generally known as WISCA.
Why don't you say what it stands for one more time?
Sure. The Workers' Safety and Compensation Administrative Account.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
Sure. And the WISCA balance is rapidly declining. In 2005, the Alaska legislature established programs such as the Workers' Compensation Fraud Unit, Peel's Commission, and so forth. These programs are funded by WISCA, but there was no increase in the WISCA service fee rate to the account for the increased cost to operate these programs. The bill allows the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to receive a greater percentage of the annual service fees that insurers already pay. So the bill does not increase the service fee for workers' compensation insurers or employers. It just allocates more of the insurance annual service fee, which is right now 2.7% of the net workers' compensation premium written. It allocates more of that to the department, which would otherwise go to the general fund. So instead of the current 1.82%, it would be 2.5%.
Representative Reinbold, you look like you have a question.
I do, and I'm glad we're on the last slide. Can you just tell me roughly what 2.5%, just a roundabout, on an annual basis would be?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, it equates to about $1.89 million. I just want to verify that with my fiscal note. It's not in the fiscal note. I'm going to verify that with my I think the updated one. Yeah, it's 1.89. That's correct. Yeah, 1.89.
Thank you.
Proceed.
And that's all that I have. I want to open to questions, but first, I believe that the commissioner would like to make a comment.
Just as an update, and I appreciate, for the record, Heidi Dragas, commissioner of the department. Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, we typically have our fearless budget leader, Paloma Harbor, with us. Paloma is in another hearing. She is not back yet, so we are working through our budget answers. But if you have any others, we're happy to answer them. Paloma can help us out with that. The one note I wanted to make for the record is that the department has received some concerns from the Alaska Trucking Association and a few others regarding our proposed independent contractor provision. We have worked with the Alaska Truckers Association to address those concerns. I believe Aves Thompson is probably listening in. Yesterday we spoke with him and we reached an agreement on his concerns, and so we hope that these changes will be included in a future CS for the committee, hopefully next week.
So just at least in terms of the independent contractor topic, which is a key part of the bill, what we see in the bill now is not what the administration is going to be recommending.
There are two minor changes that we are proposing that we would like to see adopted in a CS. They're small changes, but I can read them.
You want to direct us to the section of the bill that is applicable and then go ahead and read those. And I know Representative Reingold has questions, but I also know this independent contractor is going to be a
yes.
big topic for the committee, so we might as well get the information out.
And it's an important one, so I agree with you. The section is Section 28, and the two changes involve Section 11, Sub H, Sub II, and Sub III. The first one would read, it would change the business location aspect of that provision. So it would read instead, the person maintains a business location, and insert there, or a business mailing address. And then to continue on, separate from the location of the individual for whom or the entity for which the services are performed. The other change would be...
Just to clarify, we're on page 17, and you're describing a change at lines 1 through 3. Can you go ahead and repeat the changes on page 17, lines 1 through 3? I was actually on the prior page, so I...
I appreciate that, and I apologize. We weren't quite ready to address them, but I think it's important. So I am on page 17, line 1. That's where the addition would be after... the word business location. That's where this insertion would be. So I'll read the sentence again. The person maintains a business location or a business mailing address separate from the location of the individual for whom or the entity for which the services are performed. So the insertion is that phrase after location.
Or a
business mailing address.
Okay. And what's the other change, which I believe...
The other change is in, on page 17, and it is to addresses lines 4 through 6, that sub 3 little I, and it would read, the person engages in, and insert here three words, any kind of. So I will read the whole thing. The person engages in any kind of business advertising, solicitation, or other marketing efforts reasonably calculated to obtain new contracts to provide similar services. Those are the two changes that we have agreed to with respect to the independent contractor definition, in addition to the other ones that we've made.
Okay. All right, now the list is growing. Representative Reingold is first, and then I see Ledoux.
Holy word. With that, thank you. I have been working with amendments as well. I know that there's been pushback with NFIB, and I know some medical offices. So I do have a few amendments that I, just as a heads up, Mr. Chairman, that I will be offering in regards to this. I have them with me because I actually mistakenly thought they were due last night at 5 o'clock. But I would rather, before proceeding to amend, I would rather work with some of the sponsors of the bill before bringing them before the committee. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Representative Ledoux.
So let's go to page 16, line H, little I. Mm-hmm.
Which just for clarity is lines 29 through 31 on page 16.
So I'm just wondering, I think there's such a thing that you can get a personal liability policy which has like a rider which will cover anything relating to a business that you might have. I think such a thing exists. And assuming that it does exist, would that do the trick?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes. For the record, Marie Marks, Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. These are indicators of independent contractors, very common indicators of independent contractors. So an independent contractor is a person or entity that protects its business assets. And so you are correct that a liability insurance policy that protects its business assets would meet this prong.
Just one follow-up.
Representative Ledoux.
Do you have any idea as to whether such a policy that I think exists does in fact exist?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think the Division of Insurance probably would be the best one to talk on insurance policies in the state of Alaska.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we could go back to the slides for a moment. I had two questions. The first was on page 11. Through the chair, I just wanted to understand it. Just by looking at the slide, it would appear in the future that there will be less funds going to the general fund. I'm wondering if that's the case. Has that been incorporated into the governor's budget?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the net change to the state of Alaska is zero. It would, even though it is $1.8 million, it would be going to a dedicated fund instead of the general fund. So the net change to the state of Alaska would be zero. And I don't know if I answered your question. If there's something specific, I can bring it to Apluma Harbor, our budget genius with our department.
Follow up, Representative Eastman.
Well, my question would just be, slide would say, currently under current law, 0.88% goes to general fund. Now we're changing that to only 0.2% goes to general fund. I'd just like to understand any impacts that will have on future budgets.
Through the chair, this is Commissioner Hydragas. Representative Eastman, we can follow up with you on that. Thanks.
Follow up?
Representative Eastman.
On slide 9. I just wanted to ask, bottom line, when it talks about not an employee if at least 10% ownership interest. Now, is this going to have an impact on sole proprietorships, for example, which under current law are eligible for workers' compensation?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, sole proprietors are full owners of a business, and they do not need to carry workers' compensation insurance. Workers' compensation is an insurance program that covers employees. That's what it does. And so a sole proprietor is an owner. It is not an employee. So currently, under the current law, sole proprietors do not need to carry workers' compensation coverage. And a sole proprietor, who is a 100% owner of their company, under this proposed law, would not being an employee and therefore would not have to have workers' compensation coverage.
Follow-up.
Representative Eastman.
So I am quite interested in the sole proprietorship aspect of it. So I do believe under current statute 2330-239, sole proprietors and partners as employees, they are under current law permitted to apply for workers' compensation. Are you saying this law then prohibits them from doing so?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, there's been no change made to 2330-239. And so it does not prohibit sole proprietors from opting in. Any person who wishes to opt into workers' compensation coverage may do so. And frankly, we encourage them to do that. Often the cost of it may be worth the risk of a huge uninsured loss. So it does not change the law with regard to sole proprietors. What it does is it changes it in regard to certain business entities such as corporations and limited liability companies. And what we are finding, the reason for the change, is that, for example, a limited liability company may have one member who's 100% owner, but also put on five members who have no ownership interest in it for the purposes to avoid workers' compensation coverage. I think most employers are law-abiding and don't abuse the system, but it is a loophole that's been created that we're trying to close. So 10% is a sufficient investment, we think, in that company to make you not an employee and therefore not have to have workers' compensation coverage.
Just for informational purposes, Representative Eastman, if you go as a sole proprietor, go and buy workers' comp, it's pretty common for the carrier, the broker, to say, do you want an employer's policy or not? And so they almost always give you the option, do you want to sign up for the employer coverage and then discuss it further? And they'll often say that if you're the owner of the business, the question often arises, if you're out to dinner and you have an employer policy and you're trying to market the business and you slip as you're walking out of the restaurant, is that a claim against the workers' comp policy or not? And so I've had those discussions with the brokers, and it's always kind of an interesting conversation, but they're always ready to sell you the employer policy, and this is not changing that. Next, Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, and what Representative Eastman brought up is probably my biggest issue that I have with the entire bill as well, and I really want to talk more about it, so I'm on record. But I'll give you some examples of. I have a letter right here from an independent contractor in my district. She basically runs a quilt shop that people bring things in. When I was door knocking, this issue came up all the time in my district for people working out of their garage, whether they're making things for airplane, have a knife shop, whatever. They have a whole bunch of small mom and pop type things out of their garage. Well, a lot of them have gone out of business because of some of the workers' comp issues, and that's why this issue is really important to, I think, across the state. So I really do want to know how this is impacting a small business that may be run out of a home.
Through the chair, this is Commissioner Heidi Dragas, Representative Reinbold. I guess I'm trying to figure out what is the concern that they have. It sounds like the concern that Representative Eastman had was about whether sole proprietors and independent contractors, whoever, could opt in for insurance. And the answer is absolutely yes, that the law doesn't change that. I'm trying to figure out what your question is, which is, Are we reducing workers' compensation premiums? Well, I think this is we're attempting to do that in a whole host of ways, primarily through our Medical Services Review Committee work, which is separate from this bill. But I'm trying to identify the concern that they have specifically with the bill as it relates to their small business.
Okay. Representative Reinbold, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so basically, I have a letter. I'm not sure if it's appropriate to read the letter, but basically they're concerned that it's adding new definitions intended to force workers' compensation coverage on independent contractors. And I guess I've had so many people, because we were number one, I know, for workers' comp in the nation for the highest cost. I think now we're number two. Well, this is killing our small businesses, these issues that surrounding workers' compensation. I know that a lot of us aren't, this is not our area of expertise. What my goal is, and I'm sure many others, is not to make sure that we're, especially in a recession, inhibiting or putting undue burden on our small businesses that are trying to be efficient, run little shops out of their home by creating more costs to them.
For the record, Marie Marks, Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, this should lower those costs to those small businesses, and this is why. First, it will level the playing field to make sure that everyone who should be paying into workers' compensation is paying workers' compensation. That will spread that risk of those injuries and hopefully bring down some of those workers' compensation costs. It does not make people independent contractors who were not. What has happened is that some employers abuse the system, but I'd say far more employers generally believe that by giving someone a 1099 and calling them an independent contractor, that's sufficient under the existing law. And that is not true. And they are shocked when they have a worker who is injured that suddenly is found to be an employee. They are shocked to find out that that employee is not an independent contractor, their employee, and now they have a huge uninsured loss to cover that may put them out of business. So this bill will protect those small businesses from going out of business. I want to tell a story, I think, about because I think this...
Those are permitted.
Is that okay? Because I think this really illustrates what we're doing to protect these small businesses from huge uninsured losses. There had been an industry practice in Alaska of calling helicopter ski guides independent contractors, even though the helicopter ski company controlled the hours and would tell them when to work, provided the helicopter, provided everything, and the guides would just take the clients down the mountain, but they would call them independent contractors. There was an injury, a broken leg, and it came to the division's attention, and we worked really hard to educate and not penalize these employers, these small businesses. We didn't penalize them. We just wanted to educate them and say, you need to be in compliance. You need to have workers' compensation coverage on these guides because you're opening yourself up to huge uninsured losses. And most of them came into compliance. There was one in particular that was upset and said, you're going to cause me to incur higher business expenses, but finally came into compliance. A year later, that business, very tragically, had a guy die in an avalanche accident and contacted the division and said, thank you. Thank you for ensuring that I did not realize the ramifications of going without workers' compensation insurance. Thank you for this because that loss was covered by the insurance company. A tragic story, but it illustrates what we are trying to accomplish.
Follow-up, Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, and I understand it because I think it's important in this committee to get the intentions on the record because if there are disputes, mm-hmm. oftentimes they go back and listen to what's being said. So the intention is not to drive costs up for small businesses. And I'm going to transition into the NFIB. I'm sure you got the letter from the NFIB. If you could please address the letter, and for anyone listening, they're all online. But I think there's some extremely legitimate issues and concerns in this letter that I would definitely like you to address.
Through the chair, this is Commissioner Hyde-Dragas. I'm Representative Reinbold. We have met with the NFIB a number of times. Maria has met with the NFIB as well, and we can continue to meet with the NFIB to address their concerns.
So through the chair,
Representative Reinbold.
So there's nothing that has been agreed upon at this time. Is that a fair statement?
Just for a little bit of clarity, because I have received a similar letter and had a conversation, I think, with the lobbyist for the NFIB, who I noticed in the room, Mr. DeWitt. And I think one of the questions they raised was as to, on page 16 and 17, subsection H, about meeting three of the following criteria, and I think they list five criteria, and I think that one of the NFIB's concerns was they thought having this satisfy that 3 out of 5 test, they, as I understood it, they didn't think this statute should have those, any of those things. That section should be removed. And I see Mr. DeWitt nodding, so I at least he communicated. I understood what he was communicating, and he's suggesting these five subsections are kind of not necessary or not serving their purpose. And so I think that's what Representative Reinbold would like your view about that.
Chair, for the record, Marie Marks, Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. Chair Kleeman and Representative the Chair, Representative Reinbold, this independent contractor and misclassification issue first started, I just want to give some background, a year ago. And it was legislation, I believe, brought by Representative Ledoux. And initially there was concerns raised with it. And so that... further work was done to refine that independent contractor definition and got it to a place that we felt good about when the bill dropped. But since then, different stakeholder groups have reached out to us and expressed some concerns that they had with it. And that is why we refined it even further. And it's been refined a few times, but refined it further. Instead of having 11 or 12, however you look at it, multi-factor test, mandatory, you must meet all, 12 factors. It was refined to say you must meet 7 of these factors and then 3 of the 5 options. And so it was refined to what we had hoped to address those concerns. And the optional factors were ones that we did receive a lot of concern about whether all those could be met. And so making them optional of 3 of the 5, you don't have to meet the business location. You don't have to meet the advertising. If you have, for example, insurance on your computers or your business equipment, if you have a engage in any kind of, hopefully it will be any kind of advertising solicitation, a business card, yellow pages, social media, or have a bank account in your in the business name. And so, Chair Clayman, that the changes had been made to, we had worked as hard as we can, I think, to make sure that we capture true independent contractors and do not prevent true independent contractors from operating.
Can I comment, Mr. Chair?
You can comment. I'm going to note, just so that we all are tracking accurately, that this, the whole independent contractor definition, as I understand the bill, starts on page 15 at subparagraph 11. When it refers to a person employed as an independent, it talks about a definition, and then it has subsections A through G, which is seven parts. And as I'm hearing your testimony, a person to be qualified as an independent contractor has to satisfy A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. And then under subsection H, they have to get 3 out of the 5 in subsection H. So what, instead of having 12 requirements, which would be the first 7 plus these 5, they're actually reduced to only having essentially to satisfy 10 of the 12 total requirements.
Chair Clayman, that's correct. And we also took out some requirements that different stakeholder groups have really expressed as problematic, and which is why we replaced them with things that I think are very easy to determine, such as advertising in a bank account. It would be very easy to show that. And easy for the division to verify that.
Okay. Representative Reinbold, you had a comment. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These issues that are raised with NFIB and also with small businesses, I'm going to weigh on a scale very, very carefully, because I think it's an undeniable fact that small businesses are the heart of America. I mean, there is where innovation, families work together, communities are... have their small businesses in their homes. Youth are trained. There's people that don't have transportation, oftentimes can do jobs around the community or learn important trade skills in the community. So I don't want to do anything to stifle, especially during a recession, especially with these unbelievable deficits that we have right now. And I honestly believe that some of these small businesses work 10 times harder than some of these state government jobs. I mean, they're working around the clock, and I'm not saying some state employees do, but a lot of them are working 37 hours or 30 hours a week. And I know that these small businesses are really going through a tremendous hard time. And it's private sector, it's not government, where they're just automatically funded and their bills are all paid and their benefits are all paid. These people have to, if their ends don't meet, they suffer, unlike public employees. But the bottom line is, this is so important to me to make sure that we weigh these very, very, very carefully, the concerns of our small business. So I will tell you, this is an area where I'm going to be focusing very heavily on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that comment, Representative Reinbold. Representative Ledoux.
Oh, I really didn't have a question, but I just wanted to note that if somebody doesn't carry workers' compensation coverage, that it can actually, and there's an injury, and there's any negligence involved in the injury. Workers' compensation benefits are pretty limited compared to the benefits that somebody might be able to get if they sued at common law. And so if somebody who is supposed to have workers' compensation coverage doesn't have workers' compensation coverage, and a jury finds them negligent, the damages can be absolutely huge.
And I, that doesn't really call for a answer, but I can tell a story about a employer that owned an aircraft company and had a pilot that went down, and the pilot didn't survive, and the owner of the aircraft company was somebody that one would think knew all the reasons to have workers' compensation, and I think the first proceeding was a lawsuit, and then immediately followed by bankruptcy. Next is Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, how does this impact the average skipper-deckhand relationship in the commercial fishing industry?
for the record, Director of Workers' Compensation remarks through the chair, Representative Cobb, if I may answer, that the fishermen crew members do not fall under the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act. They have a separate statutory scheme to provide benefits called the Fisherman's Fund. So it's unrelated, and it does not impact the Fisherman's Fund statutes.
And Representative Kopp, Representative Ledoux and I are kind of here making smiling at one another. The Fisherman's Fund is only a small part of the deckhand's remedies. Then you get into the Jones Act and the whole long body of maritime law, which is actually provides far more benefits to the deckhand relative to the, not only the skipper, but as a legal matter, the boat itself, which you probably know that as a boat owner. And the Fisherman's Fund is a relatively small collection of benefits compared to the Jones Act and the various maritime law doctrines.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So may I continue?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 15 of the bill, I have a couple of questions jump out as I read that. We're adding new references into statutes so that we don't have to publish updates every year. And so a couple things. In 2014, this legislature passed House Bill 314, which required annual public notice and review of any new regulations promulgated that were had to do with the pricing for workers' comp rates. And how does by incorporating these references into this statute, it seems like we're kind of doing an end run around that requirement.
Through the chair, Representative Cobb, in 2014, the legislature changed the way the Alaska fee schedule maximum allowable reimbursement is calculated. And it did so by setting a groundwork to use to which we apply our state-specific multiplier. And that groundwork is a bunch of reference materials. Many of them are listed in Section 15. And so the statute a couple years ago was passed with these most of these intact there. And so we use the relative values established by organizations such as the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services and the American Medical Association to establish essentially a based value, just a number, for a procedure, for example, for a physician-provided procedure. And then we do not apply Medicare multiplier to that. We do not. We apply our state-specific multiplier to come up with a maximum dollar amount. And so every year, these publications are updated. Most of them are yearly. Some are longer. For example, on page 8, on line 14 and 15, the American Medical Association comes out with, and I believe it's January 1st of every year, a new book of the current procedural terminology code that's known as the CPT code book. And the Medical Services Review Committee, is the entity tasked with coming up with fee schedule recommendations and presenting those to the board. And if the board's in agreement, they become regulation. And so the MSRC and the board has already included reference material, such as the current procedural terminology codes, and in the reference material that we are adding in HB 79. What this allows us to do is that when a January 1st version comes into play that has gone through the, you know, Centers for Medicaid and Medical Services, their own Federal Register public comment period, that when it comes into effect January 1st, we can publish notice, and of course we publish notice to the public to tell them, okay, use the January 1st version of 2018. Use the January 1st, 2019 version of that. And Alaska law allows that. There's a statute in the Alaska Administrative Procedures Act that allows an agency to use future amended versions of material they're using, reference material they're using, as long as they have statutory authority to do that. Otherwise, the January 1st, 2017 version that many providers and payers are using for other purposes, we wouldn't be able to make that effective till potentially 2018. So we would always be behind using the most current version, again, of reference material that the MSRC and the board has already decided to use and agreed to use.
Representative Kopp.
So probably the transparency of this is more like, you know, I'm familiar with the international fire codes. Most cities just adopt those by reference because they update them all the time, and it's, you'd have a huge section of your city code just keeping up with that. So I do get that, but Medicaid compensation rates are a bit more, well, they're a lot more challenging for our business community, and so hence the question. But also, can you tell me why you said we kind of came up with a base rate off of Medicaid and Medicare versus commercial insurance? Because it seems to me that Medicaid and Medicare are for the elderly, the frail, the infirm, and people who are maybe not long for this world and can have very high rates, whereas commercial insurance for Medicare is based for people who are hurt on the job. They could be otherwise very healthy people. So it seems to me, if we're using that as a base, it's going to drive our rates up higher than if we actually used a market commercial insurance rate. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, and I think I'll probably just clarify that we are not using Medicare rates. It is a relative value established by a committee. It's called, I think, the Relative Value Unit Committee, involved of members from the American Medical Association and members from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. And they come in and assign a value to a procedure based on the expertise, geographic location, and so forth. They assign a number. And let's say that number is 10. Medicare will apply their own multiplier to that to get a maximum. So Medicare may apply a multiplier of 20. So 20 times 10, maximum of $200. We apply our Alaska multiplier, and let's say it's 80. So we take the relative value of 10, but we would apply our state-specific multiplier to take into consideration those types of issues and have a maximum reimbursable, for example, of 800. And so it does not, I just want to make sure it very clear, we are not using Medicare rates. It is a value established by the American Medical Association and Centers for Medicare and Medicare Services committee that comes up with these values, for example, for physician services, to which we apply our own state-specific rules. So we have the MSRC, and the board has carved out exceptions when the rules don't necessarily work for Alaska, and they have absolutely carved out exceptions. And we encourage parties to come before the Medical Services Review Committee, which will meet every year. The legislation tasked with them meeting every year to hear concerns. We have public comment at every meeting, which is chaired myself as the director, and is comprised of four public members and four members from the medical community, to take public comment. And so that should start up sometime in June again, with the goal of coming up with new recommendations to have them effective January 1st. We just didn't be in alignment, and for ease of everyone being on the same page, we want a January 1st update annually of all the rules and guidelines. And that was a result of public comment we received to say, please have a January 1st effective date so everyone knows when the new rules will be effective.
Right. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Renee. So Commissioner or Renee, whoever's most appropriate on this, I see on page, let's see what page is, page 9 on lines 11, 12, lines 13 through 16, where we are incorporating now by reference the Hospital Outpatient Prospective Payment System, HOPS, and then also the Ambulatory Surgical Center Payment System. So the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services reviews those and updates those reimbursement rates, I think, annually for each one of those. But HOPS has a market-based review, whereas the Ambulatory Surgical Payment System is based on CPI. So those two payments will diverge remarkably over time. And, in fact, I think now there's over a 40% divergence and what you're eligible for reimbursement. So this is a real challenge, if you might. So if an ambulatory surgical center, let's say Alaska Surgery Center, is getting reimbursed at 48% less than than the hospital outpatient, you can understand there could be some friction there, so I'm just wondering how we're addressing that.
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, that's an excellent question. I think I read on average that the ambulatory surgical payment system was about 65% less. And so the MSRC, the Medical Services Review Committee, again, for the record, Marie Marks, Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation, the Medical Services Review Committee and the board said we are not going to pay the amounts, the relative values to ambulatory surgical centers, the ACS values, and we are not going to apply a separate conversion factor. They decided, and that's currently in statute or in regulation, and is not changed by this, that ambulatory surgical centers get the same conversion factor of hospital outpatients and use the same relative values, just for that reason.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. All right. Thank you.
All right. And through the chair, just to be upfront, I guess, I think where the dispute lies in the billing rules that go along with that, the how things are bundled and coded. I'm not an expert in that. I'm not going to pretend to be. But I think it's in those details along the way that the ambulatory surgical system has its own methods for payment that doesn't quite the testimony that was given at the Medical Services Review Committee is using the same payment system for hospital outpatient doesn't quite work with ambulatory surgical centers. But at the end of the day, they use the same kind of base values and they have the same conversion factor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To go back to little ways, in response to a question from Representative Reinbold, you had mentioned that it's the state's interest to help some of these small businesses and others save costs. And whenever I hear the government coming to the private sector and offering to help reduce costs, I get concerned. That's not historically something that the government has been especially good at. Typically, I look at private sector as probably has a better track record in that area. And, of course, you know, there's an argument that we could help them offset some terrible workers' compensation claim that would drive them out of business and so forth. I understand that part of the argument, but it does seem very much like you know, when you go to the store and something's on sale and, you know, the manager says, hey, here, we'll help you cut costs. But then, you know, this is such a good deal that we're actually going to make you pay for it. And that's the concerning part, because the government's response in this bill seems to be, we're going to help you cut costs by adding regulations. And if you don't comply with these regulations, then we're going to go after you for fraud, which I don't know that at the end of the day that's going to help us cut costs. I'm looking at this more controversial subsection H and looking at you know, points 1 through 5 and referencing that you need 3 out of the 5 in order to qualify. And that reminds me immediately of treating and diagnosing patients in the medical profession, and how, you know, when you don't know what to call something, you just call it a syndrome, and you say you got, you know, so many of these factors. We're not exactly sure what it is, but, you know, if you've got a majority of these things, 5 out of 7 or 7 out of 9 or something, then, well, we think you're probably in this, you know, category that's not entirely defined. And if the state isn't able to entirely define it, I think that's problematic. I would love to see a black and white definition. This is what an independent contractor is, or at least for purposes of avoiding being prosecuted for fraud and being required to have coverage. You know, this is the black and white line, and I want you to be on this side of it. And certainly, as a small business, now that would be helpful to me to know the black and white side of it. But as soon as we, you know, get outside the black and white and get into the gray and the 3 out of 5, that's problematic. And I think at the end of the day, we're probably going to end up raising costs for those small business, because now more people have to come up under, you know, providing and producing insurance and so forth. And so I look at point 5, for example, page 17, line 10, you know, the person engages in a trade, occupation, profession, or business to provide services outside the usual course of business for the individual. And, you know, I immediately think of, well, what about consultants? I mean, isn't that the definition of a consultant? And aren't most of the consultants that we generally deal with, aren't those independent contractors? And if it seems fairly black and white to me that that's not an especially good example, but I'm curious, and you can hear my concern. What's the response from the department?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, for the record, this is Commissioner Heidi Dragas. I think with respect to a black and white bright line test, I think you would probably hear from stakeholders that that's not actually what they want. Many of those stakeholders are in the room. One of the things we are finding is that it's important to have some flexibility because circumstances change from employer to employer. And if you have a black and white bright line test, it makes it unworkable, despite the fact that a worker could be a true independent contractor. So it was actually the stakeholders that requested that we back away from the bright line black and white test and provide some flexibility because situations are different from employer to employer. My response regarding small businesses is that small businesses want clarity. There is a test that exists in law right now. It's the relative nature of the work test to determine whether someone is an employee or an independent contractor. So there is a test that exists. It's just vague and difficult to quantify. There's a lack of clarity. There are many businesses that would like better clarity and better notice about whether they have an employee or an independent contractor, and that's what this does. What we're not trying to do is cast a wider net. That's absolutely not what we're trying to do. We're trying to provide clarity for employers, for workers, and for the division to truly understand who is an independent contractor, who is an employee. And I believe very strongly, we have the best test that we've seen so far. We've pulled from all the different states. We've looked at all their laws. Many states, this misclassification is a huge problem in this country. It takes advantage of unknowing workers. It takes advantage of law-abiding businesses. It is essential in this state that we tackle this problem because it is rampant in Alaska. And so I think it's important to tackle this because it's a huge issue. And even though it's difficult, and I think it makes people worry in the end when they look at this definition, we actually are getting some positive responses from folks that we wouldn't anticipate getting those from, because we know it's better than what we have.
Follow up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Also, through the chair, you mentioned that stakeholders would like to avoid the black and white. My contact with some of those stakeholders takes me back to the illustration of a bullseye. And a bullseye target, the center, is very colorful, very easy to identify. Now, on most targets that I've shot at, archery or firearms or whatnot, you don't have that color on those outer edges. And I think the stakeholders that I've spoken with would love the bullseye to be very black and white, and any number of colors will do, because it's identifying, if I'm going to be caught up in under workers' compensation requirements, you know, this is what it's going to look like. Make it very clear. And when you step outside of that bullseye and you go concentric circles farther and farther away from the gold or the red or whatever in the middle, you're not making it clear. You are trying to encompass things that aren't as black and white, and the stakeholders I've spoken with would prefer that the definition of the requirements, and certainly the risk of being caught up with fraud if you're not following the requirements, be limited and black and white. And if we're trying to help them, I think that's how we help them. And the more we try and catch the 3 out of 5 or however many we end up with at the end of the day, you're catching people that are not clearly outside of the independent contractor category, and you're saying, well, you know, you don't qualify as independent contractors, so now you're going to get caught up with everybody else. That's the sentiment that I'm hearing from the folks that I've spoken with. Are you hearing something different?
Representative Easton, I would actually note that we're going to hear public testimony on this very bill on Wednesday, and that'll be a real opportunity for stakeholders to testify. I'll be happy to let them answer to the extent they. I'll be happy to let them answer. I would note that they say they are talking to many stakeholders. So, go ahead, if either of you want to respond.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, this is Heidi Dragas. I think I would just reiterate what I previously said. This test, what you're looking for is clarity. I think in this body. I think there are many in this body that are new. Some of you at this table have been here quite a long time. And if any of you can tell me how often we can see things in black and white when we're passing legislation, I would love to hear it. Because I don't think everything is black and white. I don't think the world is in black and white. What we have attempted to do with this legislation is to provide clarity and notice to employers and to workers when they are an independent contractor or an employee. And I think this definition is far above and beyond what we currently have in law.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question also about Section 28 mm-hmm. and another question about Section 29. With Section 28, I'm looking forward to the Wednesday public testimony, but also interested in how one crafts the best possible test or definition of independent contractor, noting NFIB's suggestion that we look at the IRS definition for the independent contractor. I was interested, not being that familiar with the IRS definition of independent contractor, what that is and how the IRS definition differs from this test in this legislation. And I have a separate question on Section 29, which I will ask after this.
For the record, my name is Marie Marks, Director of Workers' Compensation Division. There are many different tests in law, just across the board, of independent contractor. And the reason is that there is different goals that are reached through that test or purposes and intents of that. The IRS test, which I believe is a is a 20-factor, multi-factor balancing test. No one factor is determinative. It's just a subjective weighing test. The goal is to obtain payment, money, financial from the IRS company. The Workers' Compensation Act is to protect workers from severe injury or death and protect employers from huge uninsured losses and make sure benefits flow smoothly. Completely different goals of that. And that is why other tests do not work for workers' compensation, and that is why workers' compensation tests would not work necessarily for other areas of law. States have found, especially in the past 10 years, there's been a huge push nationwide, it's not just Alaska, that these multi-factor subjective balancing tests do not work and lead to rampant misclassification, fraudulent misclassification. And so states, and I think right now there's 23 of them, I think, at the last count, have started moving toward defining independent contractor and provide clarity in that respect. And so those tests do not work, and that is why we're providing clarity.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
And I have a follow-up on the response provided, and can ask my Section 29 question another time.
We'll give you a chance to ask Section 29 too, if you'd
like. You're very indulgent, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So on independent contractor, the IRS definition, based on your response, what I inferred or what it sounded like is that a number of states maybe in the past have used that 20-factor non-determinative definition of independent contractor for the purposes of workers' comp, and I wanted to ask if that is or is not the case, and if I inferred correctly or misinferred. I guess also in this independent contractor question, wanted to ask if this I guess, five-factor test proposed is precedented, or what the closest sort of analog, what was the closest inspiration, or if there's another state or jurisdiction that uses this test?
Through the chair, Representative Tompkins, for the record, Marie Marks, Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. To answer your first question, I'll clarify that some states still use, and other states may have used, a multi-factor balancing test, just generally, similar maybe to what the IRS test is. I am not aware of, and I haven't looked into whether any have adopted the 20-factor multi-factor balancing test. But the intent of the IRS to independent contractor definition is different. So I guess I would be surprised if they used that test and adopted the IRS test. Most states have a multi-factor or that had a multi-factor balancing test, at least 23 of them. They've been moving away from those types of tests. So not the IRS test, and I don't know how many states may have adopted the IRS 20-factor balancing test, but it is a different goal than workers' compensation. So I just don't know the answer to that. But the second question you had asked is, how did we come up with this refinement? And in response to meeting with stakeholder groups, we went back through our list, and we have read and reread the statutes in other states, in 50 states, and my staff and I both. And we found that there was four other states that had a similar type of two-part test, Florida, Maine, Nevada, and Oregon. And not exactly like that, but they did have this optional type of factors. And we liked that. We thought, wow, that may be a good way to allow flexibility to address some concerns that were raised, while at the same time providing clarity on the independent contractor definition. And so and that's how we came up with that, is we went back and reviewed our extensive list of state statutes relating to workers' compensation and independent contractor, and liked that option.
You want to ask your Section 29 question, Representative Christ-Tompkins?
Thank you. I'd be very excited to. Thank you for that answer, by the way, on independent contractor in Section 28, illuminating to me at least. On Section 29, I was intrigued reading it, and guess I wanted a little bit more context, or the value the division, the department sees in this clarification of chief executive officers potentially being exempt from workers' comp versus status quo.
Ms. Marie Marks, Director of Workers' Compensation, through the chair, Representative Christ-Tompkins. Currently, certain executive officers may exempt themselves from workers' compensation coverage, and they do this through a lengthy application process that we administer, a program. It's called the Executive Officer Waiver Program, that we have a staff member accept applications, review them, maintain them, and then we receive many inquiries from insurance companies who call our division and want to know whether that person, that executive officer, has a waiver in place or not. And it's an administrative expense and a use of resources that we found we could streamline and say, instead of us administering this program and having delay in getting back to people, letting them know whether an executive officer waiver for that person is in place, that we will move to a system where if you have a 10% ownership interest, that is sufficient. If you are a member of that company, an LLC or a corporation, if you have a 10% interest, that's sufficient to essentially waive workers' compensation coverage. And the division will no longer have to be the entity providing information on this. That information on whether who the ownership interest would be available through corporations database, and they have a great database with business records where people can find out who the officers of a corporation are, who the members of an LLC are, and what their membership interest is. It's to streamline it and make it more efficient.
Representative Christ-Tompkins, follow up.
Thank you. That sounds like an improvement. And if this legislation passes or Section 29 becomes law, do you anticipate operating budget savings or the continued need for what sounds like an FTE to manage this program And because of the sort of greater efficiency that may work, do you anticipate that that will streamline the department's budget needs?
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, there is many efficiencies in this bill. And we have, in our fiscal note, estimated that we will be able to reduce by one position. And I believe the savings, the cost savings will be, and it's not just the executive officer waiver program, it's through other efficiencies. We will no longer have to do data entry if we can mandate electronic filing of reports of injury and so forth. And so there will be an estimated reduction. And I just want to pull up our fiscal note to make sure I state it accurately. And that is $59,300 starting in fiscal year 2019.
Thank you. Representative Reinbold, I know we're at 3 o'clock, and I would, since we're hearing this next week, I'm going to give you one last question, and then I have just one query that I've got, and then we'll wind up.
And,
go ahead.
And with your judges, they don't have to answer today. I just don't know if they're coming back. But I guess
I'll be back on Wednesday.
Okay, they will be. Just stepping way back, and you don't have to answer today. But do you anticipate this bringing our statistics right now, we're number two, I think, the highest cost workers' compensation in the nation issues. Where do you anticipate us to be? In when I went to university, they always said, always have a measurable goal a year out, 5 years out, 10 years out. Where do you imagine we will be in the state of Alaska amongst other nations?
States or nations?
States. I'm sorry. Thank you.
It feels like we're a nation.
Well, we like to think of ourselves as a nation unto ourselves. But
exactly. I think you know where I'm going with this. I just want to know where you think we'll rank in 5 years.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, this is Commissioner Heidi Dragas. I don't have a crystal ball, so I can't say where we will rank. But one thing I will say is that what is driving workers' compensation costs is medical costs. This bill does not address reducing medical costs. We have addressed that through another bill. A previous legislature passed that legislation. That's was in 2014, is HB 316. This bill does not address rising medical costs. That is a huge problem. That is a statewide problem that we must address. And I don't have the answers there. What this will do is, like Marie said, it will save some administrative costs for the department, absolutely. It is also aims at reducing litigation costs for workers and for employers that hire attorneys to represent them by being able to set schedules, by being able to set penalties directly without going through the board and through the board process. There's a lot of efficiencies that way to save litigants costs as well. But as far as reducing medical costs, this bill does not address that. And that is something that we can look at, but that is a statewide problem that is sort of beyond the purview of this law.
Thank you. And I would just, the only other query, I just wanted to get a little clarification because there were questions about companies that are selling workers' comp. It's my understanding because we're a mandatory workers' comp state, in addition to the limited number of companies that actually are officially up here selling, there's this whole pool of companies that are not in state, but nevertheless coverage gets placed with them through the insured risk pool. Can you explain a little bit about how that works? Because employers are never at risk. I know that's not part of this bill, but employers are never at risk for being unable to get coverage. It may mean that they're getting covered by a workers' comp company that may or may not have offices in Alaska, but can you explain how that dynamic works in terms of both companies that are in theory in state and may have offices here, like, for example, I think Alaska National is one, and then there's all these other companies that are part of the mandatory pool in like 2 minutes or less, I hope.
Chair Clayman, and I'm not the expert, and I would probably the Division of Insurance would be the expert on this, but I can speak to say that, yes, there is a residual market, the assigned risk rate, so meaning that all employers, it ensures that all employers have some means of procuring workers' compensation insurance. So many states have created a market of last resort, the residual market, and so they can go through that and obtain these small employers that maybe have a hard time obtaining insurance, maybe they're in a very high-risk industry that's very uncommon, can go through and obtain insurance that way. Regarding how it works, I don't have the details, but I believe that that the ones who are part of that assigned risk rate are just the insurance companies are assigned to take those. They have to cover those policies, is my understanding. If they are part of that pool, as these policies come in, they have to take them. They come and they I think they alternate who's going to take and cover that policy. They're not big money makers, but that's part of being kind of the privilege, I guess, of operating and being a workers' compensation insurance company in Alaska, is to kind of be part of this and cover those. So, yes, all employers will have some means of procuring workers' compensation insurance.
Okay, thank you. That's going to conclude our – thank you for the presentation, and that's going to conclude our hearing today on this. We will be taking public testimony on House Bill 79, so we will hold the bill for further review. We will adjourn for the day, and our next meeting is scheduled for Monday, April 3rd at 1 p.m. On Monday, we will hear House Bill 172, Industrial Hemp Production Licenses, sponsored by Representative Drummond. We will also be taking up amendments to House Bill 43, New Drugs for the Terminally Ill, sponsored by Representative Gren. If anyone is offering an amendment to House Bill 43, please submit them to my office by 5 p.m. this evening. And with that, we will stand adjourned. It is now 3:05 p.m.